ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. Jerry Krause is an American missionary pilot who disappeared in April of 2013 while flying over West Africa. Jerry was a seasoned pilot with decades of experience, known for his humanitarian work, delivering supplies and offering transport for missionaries and aid workers in Africa. At first, it was thought that his plane crashed, but no piece of it was ever found. Then, in a bizarre turn of events, the mystery deepened. When his secret operative reached out to his family and told them he was still alive and being held hostage, there are some very perplexing clues in this case that may or may not be legit. So what happened to Jerry Krause? Jerry was staying in Bamako, which is the capital and largest city in Mali, a country in West Africa. My geography of Africa isn't as good as other areas of the world, so I'm going to go over some basics first. Bamako is a bustling urban center situated on the banks of the Niger River, which flows through the city and provides a vital source of water and a means of transportation. The river splits the city into two main parts, connected by several bridges. It's in a tropical savanna climate, with a rainy season from June to September and a dry season for the rest of the year. It gets pretty hot during the dry season, when it can reach up to 104 degrees. Historically, the city started as a small village that gradually grew in importance as a trading center along the river. During the French colonization of West Africa in the 19th and 20th centuries, it was officially designated the capital of French Sudan in 1908, and later became the capital of independent Mali in 1960. Since independence, there has been rapid growth and urbanization, and it's become a major hub for politics, culture, and education. There are over 2.7 million people living there, and most of the population is fairly young, with a high percentage of residents under the age of 25. Because of the younger population, the city is known for its vibrant music scene and the cultural festivals. The official language in Mali is French, but the Bambara language is also widely spoken. Bamako is not traditionally known as a tourist destination, especially because most people go to Marrakesh or Cape Town. But there is plenty to do if you find yourself in the city. The best photo spot is Point G Hill, which offers panoramic views of the Niger River and the city. It's perfect during sunrise or sunset, when the light creates a gorgeous glow over the river and the cityscape. Walking along the Niger River is an experience like none other. The river is a central part of life in Bamako, so you'll see traditional fishermen, local canoes, and families gathering water or doing laundry. Because Bamako is a less conventional travel destination, it will give you a more authentic, off-the-beaten-path experience. There are security challenges and limited infrastructure, but if you're a little more adventurous and well-prepared, it can be a great place to visit. Jerry and his family went to Bamako for their missionary work, and the city is home to a number of missionaries and Christian organizations. Present groups include Protestant Evangelical Missions, Catholic Missions, and interdenominational organizations. Beyond spreading their beliefs, many missionaries are involved in humanitarian projects, like building schools, running health clinics, and providing food assistance. Their efforts help address some of the basic needs in communities, and often provide education and medical care to underserved populations. The political instability and the presence of Islamist insurgencies in northern and central Mali have made the work of missionaries more challenging. In recent years, the security situation has led some mission organizations to either reduce their presence or relocate to more stable areas. While Mali is predominantly Muslim, at about 90 to 95% of the population, there is generally tolerance between the religious communities. Missionaries are motivated by a combination of religious beliefs, spiritual duty, and a desire to share what they believe offers hope and salvation. So while their intentions may be sincere, their presence and activities can be sensitive in a predominantly Muslim country, where religious identity is deeply embedded in the culture. When Jerry was there in 2013, Bamako was deeply impacted by the political instability and conflict that had been unfolding for about a year. They were still reeling from the effects of the military coup that took place in March 2012, which led to the ousting of President Amadou Toumani Touré and the subsequent takeover of northern Mali by Tuareg separatists and Islamic groups, including Al-Qaeda. In early 2013, France launched Operation Serval, a military intervention aimed at stopping the advance of Islamist militants towards southern Mali. So there was an increase in military presence, with checkpoints, patrols, and security operations. It was a time of heightened tension and uncertainty, because residents feared possible reprisals from Islamist groups or attacks on the city. Trade and commerce were also disrupted, resulting in an economic slowdown. There were travel warnings in effect, which cut out the little tourism they had. Many displaced people were seeking safety in the area. Things were extremely unstable at the time, which could have had an impact on Jerry's disappearance. Let's get to know more about him after a word from our sponsors.
Hey there, true crime aficionados. Looking for a podcast that's as twisted as it is hilarious?
Well, you've stumbled upon the perfect place. Welcome to Luminol on the Wall, or as we like to call it, LOTWA. I'm Becky, the sunshine to your day.
And I'm Bevy, the moonlight to your darkness. Together, we're the sisters you never knew you needed, bringing you true crime like you've never heard before.
Picture this. Two sisters, complete opposites.
Yeah, she's all sunshine and kindness, while I'm the queen of sarcasm and sass.
But that's what makes our sister chat so relatable. We're like the sun and the moon, lighting up your true crime journey with laughter and irreverence.
That's right. We dive into the darkest corners of humanity, but we don't just stop at the gore and the controversies. Oh no. We're here to roast the characters, each other, and sometimes even ourselves.
We laugh hysterically at our own jokes.
And we swear like sailors while we're at it, so if you're easily offended, consider this your warning.
But if you're ready for a wild ride through the twisted minds of murderers, join us on LOTWA. We'll cope with the horrific nature of our content the only way that we know how. That is with a healthy, or maybe excessive dose of sarcasm, wit, and a touch of crass humor.
So what are you waiting for? Hit that follow button and join our sisterhood as we navigate the murky waters of true crime together. We promise you won't regret it.
Jerry Krause was born on December 16, 1958, in Waseca, Minnesota. Coming from a large family, he was the second of five children. Even as a child, Jerry knew he wanted to serve God. By the time he was seven, he'd settled on a career as a missionary. In high school, he discovered his love of airplanes and flying, something he later realized could be combined with his career plans. After high school, he attended the University of Wisconsin for a year before heading to Laterno College in Texas, where he got a bachelor's in aeronautical science. In 1982, Jerry met and married Gina, who is from Wabash, Indiana. And in 1989, they moved to Africa for missionary work. Living near the Niger River in Mali's capital city of Bamako, the couple raised three children, Jessica, Alyssa, and Nathan. All three children later went back to the United States to attend college. Jerry worked as a member of the Mission Aviation Fellowship, the Christian organization that uses aviation and technology to bring help, hope, and healing to people living in isolated areas around the world. The primary mission is to provide essential air transportation to remote communities, particularly in areas where roads are either non-existent or extremely difficult to get through. It was the perfect career path for Jerry. but they ended up pulling out of Mali in 2009 due to increasing security concerns and regional instability. They felt there was too much risk for both the MAF staff and the operations. When they pulled out, Jerry decided to stay on with the Sahel Aviation Services to continue serving there. The SAS is a for-profit West African air charter and contract operator that provides air services for the oil and gas industry, the United Nations, and defense sector. Jerry was, by all accounts, a man of God. He was self-motivated, a wonderful father and husband, and the central figure of his family. He is adored by his family and has always been the one that pulled everyone together. He's an intelligent, calm, and laid-back guy that doesn't get stressed out easily. He's also a tough character. He thinks on his feet, calculates risk, and is able to work through high-stress situations and come out on the other end. An example of that is the time he was previously held captive. When his family lived in the Congo, a war broke out as Jerry was leading an evacuation. He ended up landing at an airport when he shouldn't have, and was held hostage there for 3 days with a gun held to his head. Although he was eventually let go, this was not the first or last time his life was in danger. He felt his overwhelming belief in God and religion would keep him safe in the sometimes threatening region he was living in. And it did, until it didn't. Let's jump into what we know about Jerry Krause's disappearance. On the morning of Sunday, April 7th, 2013, Jerry called his wife Gina before departing South Africa to tell her he was having problems starting the engines of the plane. He sent someone to the village to get the parts he would need. Gina said he was always a bit of a MacGyver when it came to working on the planes. If there were any problems, he'd just fix them and get on his way. This time, he was solo flying a Beechcraft 17-seater 1900C passenger plane. After getting the plane up and running, he first landed in Undangwa, Namibia to refuel, and then left there at 10:20 a.m., with intentions to go to Sao Tome, then Accra, Ghana, and then arrive back home in Bamako at 8 p.m. It was a routine flight that he'd done multiple times. There was nothing unusual that day, and no reason for concern. At 4:13 p.m., he radioed into the Sao Tome control tower to say he was 9 miles from the shore and about 20 minutes away. But this is when things start to get interesting. Jerry and his plane never arrived in Sao Tome after calling in, but the control tower didn't report him missing until after Monday at 3 p.m., almost 24 hours later. As Jerry was flying in, there was a tropical storm brewing, and the story they told later was that lightning hit the tower and knocked the power out, so they assumed he went to another airport, although they never checked. That night, around 8 p.m., Gina called the Bamako airport and asked where Jerry was, because she was expecting him home. He wasn't there, but they weren't concerned and said he was probably running late and would be coming in around 11 p.m. Gina totally understood and went to sleep, but woke up around 1 a.m. wondering again where he was. She called the hangar in the morning of April 8th, and they said they still hadn't heard from him, but they weren't worried about it yet. Gina went to work but called the hangar again when she got home at 1 p.m. They still hadn't had contact with Jerry. That's when Gina got worried. Jerry regularly checked in with his wife and coworkers, so this was completely out of character for him. At 2 p.m., Gina called the American Embassy to declare her husband Jerry a missing person. The search got underway quickly. His fellow pilots and coworkers, along with Gina, started calling all the airports and hangars he could have possibly landed at, but no one had seen him. The first search covered the first 50 nautical miles of Jerry's flight path to the island of Sao Tome and the last 9 miles out from where they lost contact with him. They searched the coastline area and near the airport, and there were boats in the water assisting with the search, but absolutely nothing was found. A second search took place Friday morning that focused more along the coast and inland. His family had secured additional aircraft, and the search was extensive. But one of the main issues was that the black box transponder had not been activated, and they felt this made it unlikely that Jerry crashed. The black box, which is actually orange in color, is designed to emit a signal that helps search and rescue teams locate the flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder in the event of a crash. And in the event the plane goes down underwater, there's the Underwater Locator Beacon, or ULB, designed to help locate the black box. The ULB is automatically activated when it comes in contact with water. Since it doesn't require manual activation, it ensures that it starts functioning immediately after submersion. Once it's activated, it emits acoustic pulses at a frequency easily detected underwater using specialized sonar equipment. The problem is that it only emits that frequency for 30 days once it starts. So that means the clock starts ticking right away. But as far as anyone could tell, the four emergency locators were never activated, meaning they didn't detect any type of crash or emergency landing. If he didn't crash, the only other explanation is that he was somehow forced to land in hostile territory and was kidnapped or killed, because they would need special equipment they didn't have yet to find the black box. They turned to Jerry's cell phone for more clues. He regularly uses an iPhone to communicate with his family stateside, and it was on at the time local authorities lost contact with the plane, so his family hoped they could get more clues using the GPS system. A French communications organization called Orange operates Jerry's phone, and they were able to shut it off remotely to conserve battery power. But after that, they ignored all other requests for help in the search. Jerry's family went to social media and asked for prayers for Jerry, as well as asking for people to post all over Orange's social media asking why they aren't helping with the search. And it started to work, because on April 12th, they said they would start cooperating and look up the GPS locator on his phone. On April 13th, they had still found nothing from Jerry or his plane. Nothing had floated to the surface, there was no evidence of a crash, so they felt that it meant there was a big chance Jerry was still alive. The Coast Guard was still searching, but it was looking less and less like the plane crashed. Then, on April 15th, they found out that the cell phone company couldn't track the phone outside of Mali. So the last activity they could actually see was on April 5th, and we know he called Gina on the 7th before his flight. Even though they fought for that info, it just wasn't available. At this time, they were able to get a hold of several emergency locator authorities, including a global one from Montreal, Canada, to see if they could locate the black box. But they found no matches at all in the geographic region or any emergency signals going off during the time period that Jerry was flying. Also, if Jerry did crash, the plane would have crumbled into a million pieces upon impact. The pieces would have separated and gone out in every direction pretty quickly with the tide, and they would have found the debris on top of the water, or getting caught in fishing nets, because that whole area is highly populated with fishermen. To Jerry's family, this meant there was a higher possibility that he was ambushed or kidnapped, although they had no proof. They put up a $5,000 reward for anyone who had any information about Jerry or found any parts of the plane. And $5,000 is close to a year's salary in Africa. So if anyone had found anything, they would have come forward. On April 17th, a missing persons report was filed in the U.S. so that the National Transportation Safety Board and the South African Civil Aviation Authority could start moving on the investigation. This also allowed military personnel to start their investigation into the incident as well. The Krauss family felt there was a 50-50 chance that Jerry either crashed or was captured and forced to fly for some drug lords or guerrilla members. And they had evidence to support both theories. First, they hadn't found any sign of the plane. And second, things were not adding up with the stories from Sao Tome Air Traffic Control. They never contacted mainland airports to check on Jerry's status, and they never looked for him at all. Although they later said the control tower had been hit by lightning, knocking the power out, and that was their reason why. But were they telling that story to cover up not doing what they should, or were they covering it up because they were involved in Jerry's disappearance? Either way, Jerry's family wasn't giving up on the search. they still needed a specialized sonar device to detect if the black box was underwater emitting a frequency. Finally, on April 27th, that device arrived in Sao Tome to help in the search. But after just 2 days, authorities determined that no underwater beacons belonging to Jerry's plane was detected. This pushed the family to believe even more that he never crashed. But after this, there just weren't any more clues. It was as if his plane was plucked out of thin air. With the search options limited, his family left Africa on May 6th to go back to the United States and continue their search from there. Searches continued on the ground, and on May 10th, they felt they had searched the island completely and found nothing, meaning the plane didn't crash on Sao Tome Island. So they moved their land search to the island of Principe, which was just north of Sao Tome. By May 20th, they had searched the island of Principe, and the plane wasn't there either. The Krause family outlined the reasons they believed Jerry was alive. First, being that they hadn't found a single piece of the plane anywhere. If he had crashed in the water, pieces would have been floating on top and something would have washed up by now. Second, the negligence of the refuelers in Sao Tome in providing documentation of the planes that were refueled on April 7th and 8th. Third was the discrepancy of the facts and the different stories being told about the last conversation Jerry had with the control tower in Sao Tome. Fourth was the corruption in the area and the benefit of a kidnapping. Jerry was a pilot, a mechanic, and he had a free plane. And lastly, their belief in God telling them that Jerry was still alive and not to give up hope. But in June of 2013, 2 months after Jerry's disappearance, the South African Civil Aviation Authority, which is the governing authority over the missing aircraft incident, published their official report that Jerry Krause's plane crashed and he was dead. The only problem with this finding was that there was still absolutely no concrete evidence of this. Following this, there wasn't much his family could do other than hope and pray for a miracle that he was still alive. And about a year later, it looked like their prayers worked. In 2014, an ex-government operative who wanted to remain anonymous contacted them and told them that Jerry was still alive, but gave little information to back it up. That was all his family needed to hear, because they already felt in their hearts that it was true. Then, on April 5th, 2016, the South African Civil Aviation Authority actually removed their official report that Jerry was dead due to new evidence. While this was big news for the family, they weren't privy to what that new evidence was and were completely denied access to it. But the good news was that the incident was reopened. The family released more good news on their Find Jerry Facebook page that Jerry had been seen and was alive. Also, the U.S. government actually knew Jerry's location. However, the Department of Defense didn't have the correct authorization to act on the information they had, so they couldn't go and retrieve him. Either President Trump or Vice President Pence had to give the authorization to be able to liberate Jerry. What they needed was for everyone to write to their senators in order to get the word to them and make that happen. What they still didn't know was what kind of condition he was in. And so far, no one had claimed responsibility for his kidnapping. Jerry's family believed he was being held hostage by a criminal gang and was being used to smuggle weapons and drugs around Africa against his will. They soon got word that Jerry had been seen in northern Angola. So their private investigators went to the airport and made contact there with a source that was linked to an organization that had been targeting the west coast of Africa. That's when they learned that a plane and pilot matching Jerry's description had been seen at the Ambriz airport. The source even said she saw a photo of Jerry taken in the last year, so she knew for a fact he was still alive. The Ambriz Airport was a private airport with minimal security in the Bengo province of Angola. And this was important because, according to air crash investigator Phil Schlenner, Jerry's cell phone had actually rang in Angola as well. Now, my question here is why he'd be able to keep his phone if he was being held captive. More sources then came forward and said that Jerry was last seen in Undangwa, Namibia, before he went missing. It was learned that he was dealing with some mechanical issues with the plane there. And at that time, someone could have easily gained access to that plane. They could have hidden themselves inside and then taken over while the storm was coming to make it look like Jerry had crashed. Due to all this new information, the Krause family hired private investigator Logan Clark, and his theory was that the U.S. government was somehow involved, because every time he tried to contact them about Jerry, he got the runaround, and they told him everything was too high of clearance to talk about. He even thought they might be stonewalled because Jerry could have been a CIA asset. Things died down after that news, but then in December of 2017, Jerry was spotted again. The man they saw fit Jerry's description exactly. This time, he was seen at a human trafficking hotspot in Libya. He was seen in an area called Ghat, in the southwestern part of Libya, at an old airport used by Colonel Gaddafi. Ghat is a known hub for human trafficking, so if Jerry was being made to fly planes against his will, this could be the reason he was spotted there. There's a lot of kidnapping that comes out of Ghat, and there is a direct smuggling link with Angola as well. The area is an oasis close to both the Algeriana and Nigerian borders. In the aftermath of the fall of Libyan director Gaddafi, it had come under control of the local Tuareg tribesmen. At this point, it was basically a lawless place filled with corruption and crime. Since this last sighting, there has been no news. But his family still believes this is God's plan, and Jerry will come home soon. Especially because he's not the only hostage being held in Africa. In recent years, many hostages have been freed. American sister Sue Ellen Tennyson was freed on August 31st, 2022, after 5 months of being held hostage. Jeff Woodkey, who was held in chains for years, was freed after over 6 years of captivity. Oliver Du Bois was freed after 2 years on March 20th, 2023. Dr. Ken Elliott was freed at the age of 88 on May 19, 2023. He was held captive for 7 years. On August 9, 2023, Jeff Woodkey helped for the release of a Romanian hostage, and Lulian Gerga was freed from Burkina Faso after 8 years in captivity. If Jerry was kidnapped and has been held against his will, it's been over 11 years. The chances of him being still alive might be slim, but his family believes he is and that he'll be freed soon. But what are the main theories in this case? We'll get to that after a word from our sponsors. There are two main theories in this case. The first is that the plane crashed. There was a technical or mechanical failure or a problem due to the storm, and he went down in the water. Now, we know he didn't crash on land because the plane would have been found during one of the many searches. Given the challenges of flying in Africa, including the variable weather conditions and limited ground support, it's definitely possible he crashed into the sea. But the main problem with this theory is that no piece of the plane has ever been found. He was only 9 miles away from Sao Tome when he radioed in. If he crashed in the water, the plane likely would have exploded into many pieces at impact and would have been floating on top of the water. If for some reason that didn't happen and the plane remained whole, it would have been spotted, or the transmitter from the black box would have been picked up, or some of the pieces would have eventually washed ashore. But absolutely nothing has ever been found. It's possible that, due to the storm, Jerry quickly changed direction and the plane crashed somewhere further away from where they're looking. But it's still likely they would have found some piece of it if he had crashed. Planes are big, and this one was a 17-seater. So if he crashed on land, it would have been spotted by someone. If he crashed in the ocean, it would have been found by now. There's a chance it's still lying on the deep ocean floor. The second theory is foul play. Whether that comes in the form of murder, kidnapping, or human trafficking. There's a lot of speculation that the plane was targeted by piracy or terrorism, because that's been seen a lot in West Africa. And it's hard to say who's in on it. It's possible the people in the control tower at Sao Tome knew there was a setup, and they went along with it. Maybe he even landed there and was ambushed and taken. Or maybe another plane in the sky forced him to land somewhere else. Or someone could have been hiding in the plane and forced him to land in hostile territory. With Jerry being spotted by several witnesses and ex-operatives telling his family he's alive, they have a lot of hope that he'll be coming home one day. But the fact of the matter is that there are literally zero confirmed clues on what happened to Jerry or his plane. What we do know is that his family deserves answers and closure. They deserve to either grieve for their loved one or have him back home with them. And I hope they get those answers one day. Should you travel to Africa? The short answer is yes, definitely. But Africa is a huge continent, so it depends on what country you're planning to travel to. Mauritius is the safest country in Africa right now, and last year was named the 23rd safest country globally by GPI data. Other safe countries include Botswana, Sierra Leone, Ghana, Senegal, Madagascar, Namibia, Gambia, Zambia, and Liberia. Mali, on the other hand, is not a safe place to visit right now. The United States travel advisory is at a level 4. Do not travel due to crime, terrorism, and kidnapping. Violent crime, like kidnapping and armed robbery, is common there, particularly during local holidays and seasonal events in Bamako, its suburbs, and Mali's southern regions. Roadblocks and random police checkpoints are commonplace throughout the country, especially at night. Terrorists and armed groups continue plotting kidnappings and attacks and may attack with little or no warning. The U.S. government is unable to provide emergency services to U.S. citizens throughout Mali. If you still want to travel to Mali right now, I've got a few safety tips, but they may sound rather extreme. Draft a will and designate appropriate insurance beneficiaries or power of attorney. Discuss a plan with loved ones regarding care or custody of children, pets, property, belongings, funeral wishes, things like that. Share important documents, login information, and points of contact with loved ones so they can manage your affairs if you are unable to return home. Appoint one family member as the point of contact with hostage takers, media, U.S. and host country government agencies, and members of Congress. If you are taken hostage or detained, establish a proof-of-life protocol with your loved ones so that, if you are taken hostage, your loved ones will know specific questions and answers to ask the hostage takers to be sure you are alive and to rule out a hoax. Leave DNA samples with your medical provider in case it is necessary for your family to access them. Erase any sensitive photos, comments, or other materials from your social media pages, cameras, laptops, and other electronic devices that could be considered controversial or provocative by local groups. Parts of Mali are extremely dangerous, and it would be like visiting a war zone with a slim possibility you'd get out alive. So I wouldn't advise it for your next vacation. Bamako is the safest part of the country right now, with the exception of terrorism. The people of Bamako are known for their warmth, hospitality, and strong sense of community. Hospitality is a deeply ingrained aspect of Malian culture, and the people are very friendly and welcoming. It's common for Bamakois to invite guests into their homes for tea or meals, and the tradition of serving sweet tea, known as ataya, is a common social activity where friends and family gather to chat and enjoy each other's company. The process of making the tea involves boiling green tea, adding sugar, and pouring it back and forth between small glasses to create foam. It's a time-consuming process that encourages people to sit together, talk, and socialize while the tea is being prepared. The city is deeply religious, with Islam playing a central role in the daily lives of most people there. It's common for people to pray 5 times a day, with the call to prayer from mosques being a regular part of the city's soundscape. Friday prayers at the mosque are particularly important, and many people dress in their best traditional clothing and gather for prayers at noon. In Bamako, it is often considered disrespectful for a younger person to make direct and prolonged eye contact with elders or authority figures during conversation. Averting your gaze shows deference and respectfulness, which is something that can be surprising for outsiders who are used to being more direct in their communication. There's also a common belief that whistling at night can attract evil spirits, or jinns, which are supernatural beings. Because of this, people often avoid whistling after sunset, especially in deserted areas or near the bush. It is also not uncommon for people to perform ritual animal sacrifices using chickens or goats for blessings, protection, or good fortune. The sacrifices are often carried out by traditional healers or spiritual leaders during important life events or when seeking spiritual intervention. While Mali is likely different from the culture you're used to, it's still a beautiful place with wonderful people. But right now might not be the best time to visit. But remember, wherever you go, inform someone about your plans before going anywhere. Tell someone reliable where you're going and what you'll be doing and when to expect you back. And my number one tip to staying alive on vacation is to pay attention to your gut. If something doesn't feel right, it isn't. Jerry Krause is an American missionary pilot who was flying his plane near Sao Tome on April 7, 2013, when he seemingly vanished into thin air. He was flying a Beechcraft 17-1900C plane, which is also missing. Jerry was 54 years old, about 5 feet 10 inches tall, had gray and white hair with a beard and mustache. It's possible his plane crashed into the ocean. It's also possible he's still out there and is being held hostage. If you know anything about where Jerry Krause might be or have any information about what happened, please email helpusfindjerry@gmail.com or contact your local authorities. Let's hope and pray that Jerry's family gets the answers they deserve. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.